Just remember it. If, you know, if you get all tangled up, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I mean, it's not live.
Okay.
Okay?
So the people walk by.
We were, we went to Bob Stiller's, who has Green Mountain Coffee Roasters, and he would get it something, and we were on a plane route into Burlington. And, you know, we had to do it over about six different times.
That's an exciting plant, isn't it?
Okay, well, why don't we start a little bit about your background and then how you came to Fond du Lac?
Well, I grew up in Boston, and as a poor city kid, I had dreams of trees and horses and farm life, something the opposite of what I was exposed to. And how much do you want me to get into?
Let's do the first part. Because
okay.
I think that's fascinating, and how you, you know, you had a paper route or whatever
okay.
it was you did.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
All right. Well, I grew up dreaming about trees and horses and so forth. And as I said, I was a really poor city kid. And I started working from the time I was in the third grade, working, doing errands and running errands and babysitting and so forth. And by the time I graduated from high school, I had saved $10,000. However, during that time, I also learned the value of the dollar, but I also learned that it was important to give back, because my mother would often say to me, well, you can't charge so-and-so because they can't afford it. So it was a very strong lesson early on, as, you know, I felt this was so it eventually became part of my life. And when I was in my, after I graduated from high school, I went to work for the president of Maryland Cup Corporation, which was Sweetheart Paper, Sweetheart Straws. And he had a number of brokers calling him, stockbrokers. And I was working for him during the day, and I was working at night in Harvard Square in an antique shop, and continuing to save my money. And after about a year, I decided, well, I'll open an account myself, and I started trading. And over time, turned that $10,000 into a few million. And I eventually went into business for myself. I had a paper store in Danvers, Massachusetts, and I also opened an art gallery on Newbury Street in Boston, because I always painted and loved art, and art sort of opens your eyes to nature. And so that's sort of a part of my life, enjoying, you know, going back to my childhood, enjoying trees and just natural beauty. And, you know, my life sort of went on, and eventually I became a stockbroker because E.F. Hutton pursued me, and they were following my stock trades, and because I continued in the market even though I was in different businesses. And one of my clients called me up one day, and they were checking their account, and after we finished business, they said to me, or I said to them, have you been riding lately? Because I knew they had horses and so forth. And I had recently broken up with a fellow who had a farm, and I had fallen in love with the farm life, but not in love with the gentleman. So anyway, they said yes, they had been riding, and the farm they usually ride through was being sold, and they were hoping that a developer didn't buy it. So I said, well, what are you doing for the weekend? Do you feel like company? And I drove up, and we saddled up the horses on Saturday, and we rode out behind Palmer Hill Road and came out on this wonderful property, and I was in love immediately. And we rode up to the old farmhouse, and I introduced myself to Ken Austin, and who was the owner of the property. It was the old Long Farm originally. And he said the land was under contract. And I gave him my card, and I said, well, if it should fall through, give me a call, and I'll buy it from you. And actually, I never expected to hear from him again. But 2 weeks later, he called me. And so I sent him a check, and we shortly thereafter, you know, I purchased the property.
Would you say, you know, I purchased the property in Waitsfield, Vermont, or just so you get Waitsfield, Vermont in there? So.
Okay. What was the year of the crash? 1987? In 1987, I purchased this wonderful property in Waitsfield, Vermont, which is, you know, sort of, it also included Scrag Mountain. It goes into the Northfield, goes across the Northfield Range and into Northfield as well, about, although the original property was 350 acres, so it didn't go up and over the mountain. But I since purchased, after I found that I had water on the property, I needed to purchase the land above me to protect the water and the aquifer. So I ended up purchasing a few years later from Ward Lumber. The additional, it's almost 2,000 acres in total, which includes the top of Scrag Mountain and up and over the top of Scrag Mountain and across, about 3 miles across the Northfield Ridge, and actually a couple hundred acres into Northfield. Anyway, I purchased the original property in the summer of 87, I think it was August. And in October, 2 days before the market crashed, I was trying out a horse on the property, and I fell and I broke my back. And I actually had to get back on the horse to get out of the woods. And I went off to the hospital, and sure enough, you know, I broke my back, and I was supposed to stay put, but I knew the market was going to come down on Monday unless the Fed eased. So I had my friend drive me to Boston. We put a mattress in the back of my Jeep, and I drove to Boston and shuffled into work the next day and to take care of my clients. And so it was a pretty rough period of time for me, and the market was difficult for a long time, and my back was, you know, took a long time to heal. That period was a very difficult time because the markets were very erratic, and I was in tremendous back pain and couldn't drive because the doctor wouldn't allow me to drive. I could actually feel every bounce. So it was time to work and go home, and I'd go home at night and lay on my back, and you know, I would think about just life or whatever, and somewhere along the line I started thinking that I had, or dreaming, one or the other, that I had a lot of water on my property in Waitsfield. And, you know, I don't remember exactly whether it was a dream or a wish or just rambling thoughts, but I've always had a bigger wish and a bigger dream that
feeling
I just, the feeling kept getting stronger that I had water, and I just felt it started at that time. But along with that sort of dream, my bigger dream has always been to affect children in a positive way, particularly poor children. Because most, there are a lot of charities for children with cancer or children with, and we're all very involved. I'm very involved with children that are being abused. My best friend opened a center for abused children, and I helped fund it along with her husband initially and over the years. So I've been I really believe that children are our future, and we have to start paying attention to them. But I'm also concerned about children who just happen to be poor and don't have the opportunity to maybe go to the camp of their choice or a camp at all, or in the summertime, or may need a computer for school, or they don't have a bike. Whatever it is, I would like to sort of get involved in the community and sort of from the grassroots up start to affect children's lives in a positive way. So my feeling was that maybe there might be water on my property, and this would be a way to make my bigger dream come true if I could get a company going and be able to set up a foundation to help to get involved with children's lives. And so when I got better, I started to go back to Vermont, and I started to tell my friends that what I felt was on the property. And they thought, oh, well, Ginny, this is really silly. There's no water there, and you're dreaming. And I said, yes, but every time I come up, the feeling gets stronger instead of going away. I mean, now I'm healthy again, and, I've gone on with my life, and things are, I'm skiing again, I'm horseback riding again, and I should forget about this because it's really wishing or dreaming. And so, but instead it got much worse for me. So we tried to get a dowser over to the property, but for whatever reason, he never showed up. And so finally my friends decided, well, we'll try to get him. And he still never showed up. So I researched and found out who the best hydrogeologist in the state was, and that was Wagner, Heindel, and Noyes. And I approached them and I asked them what was necessary for them. Could they look at my property, and what was the process to have them do some research? And they gave me sort of an outline, and it looked to me like it was all going to be done in increments. So I said, this is either women's intuition. Do I need to stop? This is either women's intuition or a dream that I'm wishing. And so at any point, if you think that this is not a reality, could we just stop the project, and could you work with me? And I certainly can accept that this idea is not working. And they said, yes, we'll be happy to work with you. Well, they went over to the property and they started whatever they do. And after a period of time, they called me up and they said, we're a very conservative house, but we want you to know we're very excited. And we don't like to tell you that because you never know. And so I said, well, does that mean that I have water on the property? And they said, well, we don't know. You don't know until you actually drill. So I said, well, continue your process and we'll see how it goes. So they continued on however long it took. And they called me up one day. Ken Bannister called me up and he said, we've located where we feel the primary location is. And I said to him, well, do you go down the old logging road and go through the gate and continue up the logging road? You go over Pine Brook and go up the hill, and there's a ridge there, and there's actually an old car down there. Is that what you're talking about? And I was in Boston, he was in Vermont, and you could just hear the pause, and he said he almost passed out. I mean, it was just incredible that I knew exactly where the location was, and that is the primary location. So we hired Menosh to drill, and they broke the equipment. We put in a preliminary a borehole on the way to the primary source, and even at the preliminary location, they broke the drill. And we've actually never been able to cap it properly. And then we went to the primary, and they drilled a few other locations. And the purpose of that, I think they did 4 boreholes in total. The purpose of that was to test how large the source was and check the flow and all that kind of thing. Anyway, it turns out that it's the largest bedrock aquifer in the Northeast. It's the largest source of spring water in the entire Northeast. They conservatively estimate the flow to be 1,500 gallons a minute. And Ken actually lived on the property for about a year to do further testing, and particularly test the recharge, which is the new water coming in, and that can be snow or rain. It actually can just be moisture because there's a cloud cover that goes across that range, and it's there every morning. And the trees actually pull the moisture from the clouds. And that was why it was important for me to buy the additional land, to make sure that first of all the trees weren't clear cut. And I did change, it is in forest management, and I did change the management from clear cut to selective cutting. So they think the actual recharge and flow is about 3,000 gallons a minute. But to find out exactly, we'd have to put in much bigger boreholes. We put in 6-inch boreholes, and it's not necessary because you would never use that amount of water. I mean, this flow could supply the entire United States. And as long as you withdraw below, you know, just below the recharge, then that source could go on forever. So you're talking about generations and generations. We recently just found out, and again, this was my intuition, and Ken Bannister thinks I'm a witch, because I kept telling him I felt that this was glacier water. And I felt this because the water is incredibly pure. And the purer the water, the older the old component is. So there's an old component and new water coming in. And of course, the older the water, the less pollutants there were that existed at that time. So we recently there's a new test available at the University of Waterloo in Canada, and they at one time they used to have to come down and actually visit on site, But we sent samples to Canada, and the testing is quite extensive. And the water, the old component does go back over 10,000 years to the last glacier age. So we know that the water has been there under my property, like it's just like the belly of the whale, for over 10,000 years. The boreholes now, in the spring in particular, they break the caps. So I actually have to keep the caps open all winter, and I usually try to close them up in the summertime, although there's so much pressure that sometimes they break. We did do further testing because we, you know, the state has very strict controls over that you can't affect your neighbor and that sort of thing. So we had to test all the neighboring wells to make sure that we weren't affecting their supply of water and so forth. And there was obviously no effect because the flow is just so great. And that was one of the reasons, again, why we put in a number of boreholes, and we would run them full out. You know, the hydrogeologist would, I think he pumped, I don't know exactly, but you don't have to pump. I mean, it just pours out at a 6-inch pipe at 600 gallons a minute. So he went around and he tested everybody's well. And actually, even the people across the street from me have a different component makeup of water. So they're not necessarily, they don't necessarily have the same water source. And but again, we tested the flow of all of them. And so I have all my state licenses and approvals. So anyway, once we did that, I proceeded in the town of Waitsfield to apply to the planning board because I wanted to build a bottling plant in the town. I could employ easily 50 people, probably a full-blown bottling plant could employ probably 70, even 100 people. And I'd put the bottling plant in the industrial zone, and I explained to the town fathers that I wanted to set up a foundation and to give back, particularly for children. But I also, over time, and as I went through this process, the old-timers in the town, the old Vermonters, really rallied behind me to support me in this process. And I've been so inspired by them because they would come to every single meeting and, you know, sometimes they weren't well, and it took a lot of time. And so I really want also the foundation to include seniors and to protect their quality of life. So that is very important to me. The original person to come forward was Edgar Trumley, and the amount of work he's done is just incredible. I mean, how do you ever thank somebody for that? And Ed Irish came on board, as well as Sterling Livingston and Jack Larrow and Hap Gaylord, and all these guys just showed up to all these meetings. Sterling's last words to me, he died last year. His last words to me were, "I just want to see this come to fruition, and I hope I live long enough." And he's now shining down on us and helping us with the man upstairs, I really believe.
Why do you think they are so supportive? Something too. about, you know, kind of coming in from outside. Maybe you could frame it in, even though I'm new in town, they, you know, property rights or whatever you choose to say.
You know, I came to Vermont in 89, and I'm a new person in town. And it takes time for people to get to know you. And but, you know, the people in the community have sort of watched me, and some of them have really gotten to know me well. And they really started with the meetings, but, you know, I've since made some really good friends. And the old-timers in particular, I think, accepted me because they saw what I was all about, and they believe in, they really believe in property rights. And this particular project also, you it sort of opens up, how do I want to say? This particular project, you have to preserve land. You can't build on the property. You can't have a subdivision, or you're going to you will have polluted water. You can't have a massive road system. You really have to preserve the natural habitat and the natural land. But yet, it also offers, you know, employment, and it's sort of, I think they recognize that you're going to have some change, but change with responsibility is positive change, because everything does change. But particularly, I think they've been supportive because this is a property rights issue. And as long as you're not negatively affecting your neighbor, as Sterling said, this is what we fought for in the various wars, and that's why he just wanted to see it come to fruition. So it sort of hits all the targets, you know. Vermonters in general believe in property rights, and they fight for that. They fight for individuals who are striving to preserve their rights and at the same time preserve property. So and they could see that, you know, Waitsfield in particular is pretty much dependent on the ski industry. So this year, for instance, I understand Sugarbush, before we got snow, had to lay off 200 people. And in the summertime, most people are laid off. I mean, some are full-time and some are out of work in the summertime, and they're looking for part-time situations and pretty much service types of jobs, painters, plumbers, that type of thing. This industry, the water industry, would offer full-time employment, and I think you need more than one industry in a town, and particularly when you have an industry that is dependent on the weather. Because even if you can make snow, if you don't have natural snow, people from New York or Boston aren't, you know, sort of in the mood, and so it does affect everyone. It affects the inns, it affects the restaurants, it affects the you know, the clothing stores, the supermarkets, gas stations, everyone. So I think it's important to be diversified in a town. But again, I agree with the town that they need to look at an industry and make a responsible decision for the environment and for the people in the community. And I really believe that this business, I mean, you know, the state regulates the flow. They approved, I only asked for 600 gallons a minute, not the 1,500 that my hydrogeologist conservatively said that absolutely wouldn't affect anyone, that actually, you know, things look higher. And I met all the state standards and was approved. So here you preserve almost 2,000 acres and you can employ 50 to 100 people in a town with full-time employment with good jobs. You know, you're talking about office workers, you're talking about executives, you're talking about factory workers, you're talking about truckers, you're talking about all the service businesses that go along with it. And that's adds a tax base to the town. It also sort of, it flows out again, you know, to all the other industries because people are going to be buying groceries if they can afford to buy groceries. They're going to be buying clothing. They're going to be using gas stations and that type of thing. So, aside from the fact that we want to set up a percentage of profits to go into this foundation that, you know, is my ultimate goal, it's a real solid type of business.
So what is the problem? What is preventing this from happening?
Well, as I said, I applied to the planning board, and it took a year to go through that process, and they did approve me for 6 trucks a day and sent. And then the next step was to apply to the Board of Adjustment, which I did do. And the board decided to get a legal opinion, and they were concerned that this use was not a use in the town. So they hired John Hansen from Rutland, and he studied the ordinance to determine whether it was a use by right or whether it under property rights or whether it was a conditional use. And I must say he was a very honorable gentleman because he sort of, once he was given this job, he would not take personal testimony from anyone, including the town or from me or my hydrogeologist or anyone, but you could submit any information in writing. And, you know, we sent him all our data and so forth. But the real issue was he needed to look into the ordinance in Waitsfield. And several months went by. He took quite a long time in his studies, and he came back and he decided that his legal opinion was that this was a use by right under the definition of agriculture in the town. And I guess the ordinance expanded on agriculture and actually suggested that the town fathers and the community be creative in their endeavors of agriculture. So we were really thrilled at this, and I also felt this is an agricultural issue because once you know that you have water, there are certain things you have to do to preserve that water, and there are things that you shouldn't do so that you really have a fiduciary obligation, particularly a source of this magnitude. You can't, as I say, you can't subdivide. You have to have certain vegetation. For instance, you know, the trees and the vegetation are important. How you farm is important. Whether you, obviously you can't use pesticides. You really have to do conservation farming versus till farming even. So, you know, you really have to actively do certain things, and you have to not do certain things. And anyway, the Board of Adjustment decided to ignore John Hansen's legal opinion and denied me a use. So I had no recourse other than to appeal that in the courts. And since John Hansen's legal opinion was an agricultural use in the town of Waitsfield, that's what we went through the court appealing the Board of Adjustment's denial of that. And we lost. We lost in the lower court, and again we lost in the Vermont Supreme Court.
Why?
So we don't, at this moment I can't open a business, and I can't withdraw water other than for my own use on the property.
What was the ruling of the Supreme Court?
The ruling, let's see if I can, the ruling of the Supreme Court, if I remember it correctly, the Department of Agriculture as yet has not acknowledged water as an agricultural product. The Vermont Department of Agriculture has not acknowledged water as an agricultural product. However, other states are regulated by the Department of Agriculture. So that there are a number of states across the United States that do regulate water under agriculture. The Vermont Department of Agriculture has given water a separate seal, and there's been some debate about it, about recognizing water as an agricultural product. And I hope, I'm really hoping at some point that it is recognized, because I really believe that unless it is recognized as an agricultural product, that the face of Vermont will change, because farming is always changing and evolving, and people, it's hard enough to make a living from your property, and farming always has to sort of be creative in order to exist, and always has been. It's been sort of a difficult road to go. And what's happening is people are subdividing their properties because they can't continue to make a living.
So do you look at this ruling as a setback, or do you look at it as knocking out your dreams, or I guess I'm trying to get at how do you look at this ruling, and what are you going to do, as much as you can tell?
I look at this ruling as I went down this road, and I didn't get there by going down this road. And my training in life has always been, if this road doesn't work, I need to retrace my steps, come back down that road, and now try this other road. So I don't give up and I don't go away. And that's probably why the old timers like me so much, because I may not have been born a Vermonter, but I think we're cut of the same cloth. And that road didn't work, but maybe the next road will.
You did it, and you ended very nice. Now let's hope to heaven we can use it. That was nice to say.
Okay.
Anything that came up that...
Some of the beginning I didn't like because I said it to you before, so I didn't feel as spontaneous. Like this new part is more spontaneous.
Yeah, but that's good.
I think if you were sitting there, it would have been easier for me to go back on.
I probably should have told you don't listen to your tape.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that pops out at me editorially here is I don't know if we ever very succinctly said, you know, I want to build a drinking water bottling plant, you know, whatever the term is for that kind of, you know, the expensive bottled water, drinking water bottling plant kind of thing.
Okay.
Did we?
I may have missed it.
We touched on it, but you're right.
But maybe we should do it. Why don't we do it?
Okay. What about the bottling plant? What's the question?
So you have this aquifer.
Yes.
What I want to do is...
Okay. What my dream is to do with this wonderful water is to build a bottling plant in an industrial zone. And actually, I have all the financial... support available to me, and we want to build a bottling plant and bottle spring water under the name of Virgin Vermont, and supply this water to starting small and growing over time, and build a company. We're also talking about natural sodas, and we have to think of a name for that. We're a socially responsible company and want to give back to the community. I've got people that are on my management team that are Vermonters that are interested in coming on board with various expertise. Because obviously I can't do everything myself, but I have a wonderful chemist whose wife is originally a Vermonter, and they want to settle in the community and come home. And his family was in the soda business for 100 years or so. So that he brings wonderful recipes for natural sodas. But the spring water itself is, you know, as I said, this is, you know, our selling point is that it's really the best water available, and it's world class water. It can compete with any of the waters out there. A number of the large water companies have actually looked at this water, and again, they can't believe the purity. So we want to build a responsible company. I don't know if that was said too well. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't. I also really believe that this isn't just a gift for me. This is a gift for all Vermonters, and we want to do a public offering, a Vermont offering initially, so that anyone interested in being part of this can buy the stock and eventually do a public offering. And for instance, if you bought 1,000 shares of Ben and Jerry's stock when it went public on the Vermont offering, it's worth about $50,000 today. So hopefully our stock will do as well.
We'll all line up.
This is Virginia Houston Runto. That's the end of the room, Tom. Great.
That was perfect.
Was
really,
it good?
I loved what you said at that. You
the
know,
end.
You and the Vermonters. Yeah, that I think we might even be able to end the program with that.
Yeah.
It's always tricky.